Welcome to Notes from the Western Edge, a monthly 30-minute on-demand webcast featuring musicians who create on the edges of jazz, new music, electronics, and a broad expanse of sonic spaces in between. In program number 9, we'll hear from two trumpet players, one on the East Coast and one on the West. In the late 1980s, Dave Douglas was playing and touring with names not ordinarily included in the same sentence: Horace Silver, Tim Byrne, Dr. Nerve, and the Bread and Puppet Theater. Since that time, he has gone on to record 24 albums as a leader, his most recent being Meaning and Mystery on the Greenleaf Music label. Since growing up in a family of educators in Florida, Ron McCurdy has moved from one coast to the other while making a couple of stops in the Midwest, where he taught jazz studies at Kansas University and the University of Minnesota. Currently, he is chair of the Jazz Studies program at the University of Southern California, running a summer music program at Disneyland, and playing the trumpet in his Langston Hughes project. I hope you enjoy the show.
We're all just fishing around in the giant ocean of sound and of being. I actually threw away my tuxedo on December 10th, 1993.
Like most musicians working on the creative edges of music, Dave Douglas's path has been uniquely all his own.
As a child, my world of music was just very interior, very on the inside, listening to records and being moved in very profound ways by the music and not being able to really talk to anybody about it or know what it was. So it wasn't until later that all of those feelings started to come out through my own music. I guess I'm a fairly late bloomer. I didn't really become a band leader until I was just about 30. And I think that was because I came up as a mainstream jazz trumpet player. And when it came time to create my own music, I didn't know what to do. I felt like, you know, I was always writing tunes, but they were kind of, you know, coming out of mainstream quintet music, if you will. And to put my name on something as a leader, I felt like I had to have something else to offer. So that was when I started examining all these different ways of trying to put music together.
All these different ways indeed, since he threw away his tuxedo in 1993, after deciding to stop saying yes to every gig that was offered to him, that he would no longer play weddings, bar mitzvahs, commercial jingles, or on the streets of New York City. Douglas has released 24 recordings under his own name, displaying a stylistic range unmatched by any other artist today. His first album, released in 1994, Parallel Worlds, features a quintet of trumpet, violin, cello, bass, and drums, not your usual jazz quintet. Later that year came the Tiny Bell Trio, with trumpet, electric guitar, and drums, so named because they played a regular weekly gig in Soho at the Bell Cafe, which had a tiny stage. Their song list included mostly Eastern European folk music and even a composition by the Romantic composer Robert Schumann, all filtered through the lens of jazz improvisation. When I heard Douglas with his current group at the Jazz Bakery in Culver City in April 2006, he had just returned from England, where he premiered and recorded his Blue Latitudes, a one-hour piece commissioned for the 14-member Birmingham Contemporary Music Group, along with three improvising musicians, Douglas on trumpet, Mark Dresser on bass, and Susie Ibarra on drums. We're listening to Painter's Way from Douglas's latest release, Meaning and Mystery, with Douglas on trumpet, Donnie McCaslin on tenor sax, Uri Kane on electric piano, James Jenness on bass, and Clarence Penn on drums. Another tune on this disc is Blues to Steve Lacy, the late soprano saxophonist whose music came as a revelation to Douglas and whose recordings of Monk tunes gave him some help.
Those early records that he made were a really good way to learn Monk tunes because he played them so thoroughly and well, and sometimes on certain Monk recordings, you know, certain notes would be a little mysterious, and then you could always go to Steve's thing and kind of figure it out, and then maybe you'd decide later on whether you wanted to do it his way or not. But, you know, he was just the prime interpreter of that music in that period. And then, of course, you know, the work that he did with Cecil Taylor was really revelatory for me. And when I first came on the scene, he was really active. He had his quintet with Irene and Steve Potts and J.J. Avenel. And who was that drummer? Oliver
Johnson.
Oliver Johnson, mm-hmm. Yeah. And then later, John Betch.
Great.
Fantastic.
Great band.
And then, you know, I met him, I think, in the mid-90s or so, and we just would run into each other, and eventually I got to do a bunch of gigs with him, playing Monk tunes, and with him and Roswell Rudd and J.J. and John Betch. And it was a high for me. It was an enormous challenge to stand between Steve and Roswell and try to find a third way in there. And I learned so much doing it. And also, I felt that Steve was so generous with his time, with his energy, with his artistic vision. He was just, you know, willing to open right up to me and talk about music. And right to the end, he was saying things like, oh, you know, next spring we're going to go out and do a whole bunch of stuff. You know, will you sign on? And this is, you know, 3 years into a battle with very ferocious cancer.
Another musician who has provided revelation for Douglas is the guitarist Bill Frisell. In 1987, fresh out of NYU and shortly after leaving Horace Silver's group, Douglas asked Frisell to join him on a recording date in New York. At the time, Frisell was too busy with other projects. 16 years later, Douglas asked again, and the album Strange Liberation is the result, with Frisell joining Douglas's working quintet. Here's what Douglas wrote in November 2003 about his tune, The Frisell Dream. Several years ago, I had a dream. I was listening to Bill's trio in concert. In the dream, they were playing a piece of music I didn't recognize, and I woke up and wrote enough of it down to later remember almost the whole thing. I thought it was one of his pieces, and to this day I have no idea where it all came from. I call it the Frizzell Dream. Douglas told me that he's always been interested in the ways that different musical languages come together, a collision of different codes, as he puts it. As he works through these collisions in his own music, however, one thing remains constant, the sound of his trumpet, big, bold, and full of nuance. That's Kirsch Calais on tablas on Douglas's tune Freak In from his album of the same name, released in 2003 on the Bluebird RCA label. I asked Douglas to name some other musicians who had inspired or influenced him. Rather reluctantly, he answered me, starting with his obvious admiration for Miles Davis, and then proceeding with a long list of American greats.
If I say, yeah, Miles was pretty good, I don't know if your listeners will catch the tone of sarcasm, so I'll just say it. Yeah, absolutely a hero. But I think that American music has so many heroes to offer, and so many of them are overlooked, that It's hard for me to sit down and talk about influences. But yeah, of course, Miles Davis and John Coltrane and Wayne Shorter and Thelonious Monk and Charles Mingus and Henry Threadgill and Anthony Braxton and Julius Hemphill. And, you know, I'm not even going further back and talking about Roy Eldridge or Dizzy Gillespie or Fats Navarro or Booker Little or Freddie Hubbard, just to mention some trumpet players, Lester Bowie. It's such a rich culture and history here in America, and I think that's not recognized to the degree that it ought to be. I think in the contemporary music field, too, you know, John Adams has no shortage for work, but I think that in a cultural sense, he should be this icon of the importance of American art.
Roy Eldridge to Lester Bowie to John Adams is quite a leap. But leaping through collisions while maintaining his own vision is what Dave Douglas does. If you want more evidence, check out his new website at greenleafmusic.com to hear his music, read his essays, drop in for an occasional live chat, or purchase some of his music. By the way, his playlist on his Greenleaf radio stream, also found on the site, includes music by Igor Stravinsky, Roland Kirk, Herbie Nichols, Bjork, Joni Mitchell, and others too numerous to mention. Collisions indeed. In Los Angeles, for Notes from the Western Edge, I'm Richard Paskey. Ron McCurdy tells the story behind this tune, once again, for the first time.
What brought me to L.A. was I came to be the director of the Thelonious Monk Institute here at USC. I did that for 2 years, and I enjoyed having a chance to be around the great talented kids that were a part of the program, and I thoroughly enjoyed being around the jazz masters. I didn't enjoy the job being fully administrative. So I didn't get to teach. I didn't have much of a chance to play. It was all designing curriculum, planning international tours, hosting the Jazz Master. And it was great, that part of it. But I felt somewhat shackled because my whole professional life had been teaching. And after doing that for 2 years, I was going to go back to the University of Minnesota when USC stepped forward to offer me a tenured full professorship here. And then I became, later on, became chair of the department. And having a chance to teach again, it was such I felt emancipated. I felt so free, and I felt so inspired by that I wrote the tune once again for the first time, because it felt like the first time that I was teaching again. So that's sort of the history behind that particular piece.
McCurdy's journey started early with lots and lots of practicing.
Well, my early musical life, I was like so many others. Was involved in classical playing. I grew up in Florida, and had a great high school band director named Bill Pyfrom, who was a very well-rounded musician. And we did marching band, we did concert band, we had jazz band, and he exposed us to a lot of music. So my early playing as a musician was steeped in Charlier, Arbenz, all the technical books, Schlossberg, all the things that any other classically trained trumpet player would do, because he felt that before you can play any genre of music, you needed to be able to play the instrument. So my early life was spent learning scales etudes and all those kind of things to become a well-rounded musician. And it wasn't until later on, when I got to college, actually, that I began to actually play in what I would call an organized jazz band. But fortunately, growing up, my parents, both of whom were educators, also loved music. And I grew up in a household where I heard jazz from day one. I mean, my father was a lover of music. We heard everything from the Ellington Band to Sarah Vaughan to Miles to the Ink Spots to Bach's B Minor Mass, you name it, we had a very eclectic collection of music. So I grew up in a household where music was being played all the time.
I asked McCurdy if it was difficult making the transition from being solely a classical musician to being one who also played jazz.
Fairly, I wouldn't say that it was easy, But being able to play the instrument made it easier, I should say, because I wasn't stumbling over range or technique or any of those kinds of things. I mean, I had a very strong foundation on playing the trumpet while in high school and in undergraduate college. So what happened for me is that I remembered, I mean, it was sort of that the memory of hearing Miles and Train and Bird all settle in my memory banks as a child. When it came time for me to play, I was able to sort of recall all the tunes that I had heard growing up. Like, I knew Scrapple from the Apple when I was about 8 years old, but I didn't like it. I wasn't sure what it was, but I heard it all the time, which is why I tell my students right now, there's no substitute for listening. I mean, you can have all the books and all the transcription books and all those kind of things that you want, but there's no substitute for having heard and had a chance to actually internalize the music. And I think through happenstance, through osmosis, I was able to internalize the music at a very young age from being exposed to it.
If you spend even a few minutes with him, it becomes immediately obvious that McCurdy loves to teach and to work with talented young musicians. But getting him into the studio to record his own album took a little help from his friends.
Most of my life has been in education, and when I moved to California, I had never done an album as a leader, a solo album. I had been on other people's records before, but I hadn't really done anything where it was my compositions and I was the leader. And when I moved here, my friends, Patrice Rushen, Shelley Berg, Jeff Clayton, and others I told them, man, you know, I've been playing this music a long time, but I've never really done any record of myself. I said, well, let's do one. I said, well, let's just do one. So they were very encouraging, I should say. And I did a record about 3 years ago, my first record called Once Again for the First Time. And Patrice is on it, Shelley Berg's on it, Jeff Clayton's on it, Ken Davis, who used to be the bass player on the Tonight Show band, is on it, and my cousin Roy McCurdy is on it. And I'm doing three or four of my original tunes and a couple of other covers on it. And for me, when I play, I mean, it's, having a CD is almost like having a business card. I mean, I have no illusion that I'm going to all of a sudden be at the top of the Billboard charts with the record that I'm doing. But teaching at a place like USC, where the students are at such a high level, for you to be able to teach, you have to sort of be able to walk to walk and talk to talk as well if you're going to be teaching these caliber students. So for me, it was a chance to have a snapshot of my own artistic development and growth, and to have a product that I can take to different places and that I can do at different jazz festivals and with my quintet. So I do Spazios every now and then. I'll do the Western thing around here. I'll do a few jazz festivals. But the last couple of years, my biggest artistic thrust has been with the Langston Hughes Project.
In a town named after Stanley, night, each night comes nightly. And the music of old music's borrowed for the horns that don't know how to play on LPs that wonder how they ever got that way. What time is it, Mama?
Great American poet, novelist, and playwright Langston Hughes is probably best known for his writings during the Harlem Renaissance in the 1920s and 30s. McCurdy's Langston Hughes Project is a multimedia performance piece that combines music, slide projections, and spoken word to evoke a world of thoughts and images through Langston's poem, Ask Your Mama, 12 Moods for Jazz. After I saw a performance at the Skirball Center in Los Angeles in March 2006, I asked him about his goals for the project.
Our mission for the poem was to educate young people, because my colleague and I, when I was a professor at the University of Minnesota, Dr. John Reidenau, who started this project, our mission was to educate our students about their history, particularly African-American students, because we seem that seemed to be the biggest disconnect between African-American, young African-Americans, and understanding the struggle, their history, their lineage, and all of that. Then we realized that, well, you know, why limit it to just African-American kids? This poem has such a broad message, not only about America, but also references to Africa. At the time that this poem was written, Nigeria, Ghana, they were also striving for their independence from imperialism. So the whole idea of looking at one's culture through the eyes of a storyteller like a Langston Hughes, like who's a, how I would call him, an American griot, to really tell a story in a very witty, somewhat objective. There were a couple little jabs given here and there in the poem. You know, he made the references to all the Dixiecrats being put out of power. Comes the Colored Hour and Martin Luther King as governor of Georgia, and he makes other references to plantations being owned by blacks and whites working the black plantations. And you have Mammy Faubus, Mammy Eastland, Mammy Malin, and these were, you know, staunch segregationist governors of Georgia, Alabama, and the like. And how, if you understand history, you'll understand hopefully what your place in the world is today, and how are some of these incidents that we read in the poem that was written over 40 years ago, how are they relevant today?
And they asked me right at Christmas if my blackness would it rub off. I said, ask your mama.
The excerpts we just heard are available for streaming on the Langston Hughes Project website. McCurdy hopes to release a studio recording of the piece later this year. Ron McCurdy's life is immersed in music, playing, teaching, composing, recording. For him, like so many jazz musicians before him, it's all about the music.
Jazz musicians have long been ahead of the whole social curve. I mean, at a time when the rest of the world was quite segregated, jazz musicians, as you well know, were always finding a reason to come together and play together. I was in South Africa a few years ago during the apartheid regime. It was unacceptable for black and white musicians to play together, but they still did it. Risking life and limb, they still found ways to come together to play music, because it's about music and the art. It's not about race and all of that.
In Los Angeles, for Notes from the Western Edge, I'm Richard Paskey. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. Next time will be a surprise. Tune in on October 1st to find out what it is. In Los Angeles, for Notes from the Western Edge and Fresh Ears Media, I'm Richard Paskey.